right, ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Saul Alfred Servano Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We are on location at Saul Alfred Servano's. We have an awesome guest, no stranger to the broadcast or WWDB. Let's introduce our guest, our host first, John Servano's. How are you?
I think I'm good. You ever really know, though?
Now, listen, it's a good point. It's a great. And Jeff Gross, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thanks, Joe. Thank you both for having me.
It's our pleasure. And so, having said that, you know, it's great to be in the room with two Sixers fans. Okay, and by the way, we're pre-recording, so by the time we start this this broadcast airs,
we'll know if they're in the playoffs.
We're gonna know. Okay, but having said that, let's talk a little bit. Tonight is. It's Tuesday or Wednesday night here at the 17th of April, and the Sixers are playing tonight. And both you gentlemen are scheduled to go to the game, although Jeff Gross is on the injured list.
I'm on the injured list, but I still may play.
Right. Well, I mean,
all you have to do is sit.
All I got to do is sit. Right?
Well, he has a son at home that's praying that he actually sits tonight and doesn't play in the game or go to the game. But let's talk a little bit about the Sixers. Obviously, Embiid is back. Scared the hell out of us last week a couple times, right?
He continues to scare the hell out of us.
You know,
as Stephen A. Smith says, he gets injured walking across his kitchen floor.
Well, it's true.
It's true. But to me, and I've said this a number of times, you know, first of all, who were they talking? I saw, who was it that they were? I saw an interview recently. I think it was Shaq, because everybody always. They were talking about AI, about how AI, if AI could play in today's game, of course, you know, I mean, going to the basket and his athletic ability and all that, but they're talking about the shooting, because today's a shooter's game, and Embiid, by, you know, who in the world?
He's a fantastic shooter.
Incredible,
fantastic.
Right? He's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so. So it is a different game. You never saw, you know, centers, you know, back in the day, Moses Malone and Shaq and all those guys hitting threes on a constant basis. However, the thing that makes me most nervous about Embiid, and I don't think it's a secret, is, you know, he's constantly going to the hole, constantly going to the basket.
And he constantly falls.
He constantly falls. But he reminds me, even though he seems somewhat graceful, he's a plotter. So he's coming down hard on every one of his, and you know, it don't take much. Like, he's not incredibly, he's not like a gazelle going to the basket who's light footed. He's coming down incredibly hard.
He's certainly not a string bean, that's for sure.
No,
he has good weight on him.
He's like 280.
And like my grandmother used to say when I was growing up, I used to complain that I was too short. I hated it. And she would say, Jeff, relax. She said, "You're lucky that you're short. The bigger they come, the harder they fall."
Ah, there you go.
And there you go.
I also don't knock
out light bulbs when I walk around.
Well, you know, it reminds me of my eighth grade basketball team. There wasn't one of us over 5. Well, no, there was one of us over 5'6". We were like the Teen Wolf team, right?
Yeah.
Everybody was short, but we were all good ball handlers. You know, but so what do you think? Do you think the Sixers got a shot? I mean, what do you think? I'll go to.
Yeah, I actually do. I you know who I've really, really been impressed with lately is Oubre. He comes to play every night. He's so enthusiastic. He brings so much energy, and I want to tell you, he just keeps getting better. So with him, you got Embiid. You obviously Maxie. Got Maxie. You got the factor known as Lowry. You don't really. You just feel good when he's on
yeah,
the court.
Yeah, he's just. He's
you just
a,
feel good when he's on the court.
He's a leader.
Everybody. Yeah, he's guiding everybody. You know, you never know what you're going to get with Tobias Harris, but, you know, you're going to get good defense. I don't know if he's going to score any points. You know, one game he plays, scores 20, the next game he didn't score any.
There is a little inconsistency there.
Yeah, yeah. But the interesting fact in this whole thing, and what's become very apparent, is when Embiid plays, they have a 65% winning percentage,
right,
which is extraordinary.
It is.
It's Celtics, better than the Celtics. When he doesn't play, they're a lottery team. I've never seen one player make such a difference on one team, but that's basketball. One guy can just totally change a team. You're not going to get that in any other sport, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's an extraordinary difference. And you go to the games, you notice it's not just his offense, his defense. He clogs that middle up. There's no one driving into the lane. They back out when they think they have a lane. I could go on and on. But, you know, we're all holding our breath constantly.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah, you never know what you're going to get, you know. Yeah. But they are they're great with him, and tonight they got him. So they have a good shot.
You know, we'll
see what Jimmy Butler does.
Jimmy Butler.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a sore spot for me. You know, there's a couple sore spots in the NBA.
If it wasn't for Ben Simmons, Butler would have never
Exactly.
That's it. Exactly right.
It's true.
Want to hear something great?
Yeah.
Did you ever hear of a 4-20?
No.
Okay. A 4-20 is an Australian beef patty. When Simmons came here to Philly from Australia, he got these people that made these meat patties to sign a contract with Wells Fargo. I think it was the 10-year contract that they would put their meat patties in Wells Fargo, and it's one of the concessions.
Really?
So now that Simmons is gone, they're still stuck with that contract, and nobody eats that stuff.
I didn't even know it existed.
When you go there tonight, take a look. You'll see a 4-20. It's called a 4-20 traveler because you can walk around with it.
Oh, wow.
It's one of those meat patties, but they're from Australia.
You know, and when I think of Ben, of course, I think of Tatum from the Celtics, and I think of Jimmy Butler. You know, you got two guys
There's so many players that we could have had.
So many.
And what a Ben Simmons doesn't realize.
How about don't forget about Mikal Bridges?
Yeah, of course. We didn't draft him.
I mean, there's three guys
His mom worked for the Sixers.
Yeah. How do you trade him for garbage?
Yeah.
It's basically what it amounted to.
Well, you
but
know.
That's the whatever those guys were from Phoenix who came in and become our GM. Congandolo or whatever
yeah,
his name
yeah,
was.
Colangelo. Yeah, well, you know, having said that, you know, when you think about Philadelphia sports, right, and Ben Simmons will forever go down in history. Yeah, I when I think of situations like that.
Well, he's not just bad for Philly. He's just bad.
He's bad. He's bad for Brooklyn.
I mean, Brooklyn, he's even worse for Brooklyn. He doesn't play, period.
But I'm thinking of Philly in the sense that, you know, all the players that have played here and, you know, some players have folded. And, you know, he would obviously be at the absolute top of the list. But if there was one moment in sport in recent sports, and we may have talked about this, I'm not sure, but in recent sports history that the history, the future of a player's career, literally, could have been it was going one way or the other within minutes, and that was Alec Bohm when he said, "I hate this effing place." Right?
Yeah, I still don't know how he got away with it.
Well, he did because he apologized. And he was just a kid, but somebody got him. One of his fellow players said, somebody called down to that locker room and said, "Whatever you do, you own it." And then, you know, he did. He came out, he owned it. He said, "Listen, look, I'm having a bad time here in baseball. It's as cruel as the day is long, right?" But he comes out there the next night, gets a standing ovation. And now, when they win and they go to the World Series, they asked him right on TV, "What do you think of this place?" And he said, "I love this place." Right. So what I'm saying is, had Ben Simmons come back, and no matter how cruel this city is, okay, all of us have been fans since we were kids, no matter how cruel it is, you come out, you own it. Had Ben Simmons come out, taken 10 shots, missed every one, but he took him and manned up the next game. He gets a standing ovation, too. It's all forgotten.
I think you're right.
Especially
after that game against the Hawks, and he gave up the slam dunk for whatever. I don't even know what it was anymore.
Oh, yeah, I forget who he passed the ball
up, but he had an open slam dunk.
Yeah, right. I think it was a rookie. Who was it? The defensive player that we had there,
Matisse Thybulle.
Thybulle, right.
Right.
He passes it to Thybulle, and probably because he knew he was going to get fouled and he didn't want to go to the free throw line.
Yeah.
But, you know, this city is as hard as we are. We're equally as forgiven. Mike Schmidt, but Mike Schmidt with the wig on when he went out to first base. I mean, this city is, and then you look at the absolute legends in this city. The legends, okay? And then, you know, you guys are Sixers, you know, real Sixers guys. And, You know, obviously Dr. J, the Moses Malones, the Mo Cheeks, Charles Barkley's, and of course Allen Iverson's, the guys that laid it out there, right? When I think of Tobias Harris, okay, I mean, he's a max player. Somehow he gets away with it in Philly. You know, he has some good games and he keeps coming every day, but he's a max player. Man, that contract just keeps on giving, man.
Well, it's also he fell into a max contract because they lost Butler and they had the money and they were like, well, we're not going to let two guys walk.
Right.
And he was just in the right place at the right time for financial purposes. I really think he would have never gotten paid if Butler stayed with the team.
Right.
But everybody knows Butler was like, I can't play with Ben Simmons. He's got an attitude problem, and Brown at the time was married to Simmons because of his dad and playing with him in Australia and just didn't want to give up on Simmons because of all the potential. And Butler was like, well, I'm done. I got to get out of here. And he got an attitude. He always has an attitude to begin with, but it was like attitude on steroids, and they were like, we got to go.
Well, he was a great player, but, you know, once the news came out that he couldn't shoot foul shots, you know, he's done.
Who's right? that? Ben Simmons?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He can't shoot a foul shot for his life.
And he never got better at it.
Never.
Yeah, the hack of Ben. I get it. But you just – listen, Shaq sucked also, but he's still one of the greatest players, and he just kept doing it.
Well, and he owned it. Yeah. He owned can't shoot foul shots.
Yeah, he owned it, and he ate everybody alive, like getting out of the way. You know, you watch old films of Shaq when he came into this league. He was – lean, mean. He was going. Yeah. He was going coast to coast.
And now he's rich, rich, rich.
Oh my god! Oh my god! He's
supposed to be an incredibly generous guy.
He is.
I've heard stories about his generosity. They're extraordinary stories.
Yeah, I mean the guys. You know, and by the way, I think Charles
like walking into a Walmart and buying and just deciding everybody buy whatever you want. It's on me.
Yeah.
He spends $30,000 like that.
Yeah. Oh my god. He's worth, I think.
He knows not to do that at Saks Fifth Avenue.
Even though he's worth like $600 million. I think Charles Barkley.
Well, he's a great pitch man. I mean, he's pitching everything.
You know, Chuck, I think
the voice of Subway.
Right, the voice of Subway. But here's the thing. I think he learned a lot from Shaq. And he's taking advantage.
They're both making a fortune post-basketball.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And Chuck wasn't before this.
Chuck's got a personality and a half.
Oh, you know, I'll tell you what's interesting about Barkley. First of all, here's an opinion I have on Charles Barkley. I believe that he's one of the, inch for inch, okay, and his package, his physical package, okay, 6'4 and a half, okay, 300 pounds. He was like 280, 275 when he was. But, I mean, I think, inch for inch, he is one of the greatest players to ever.
I agree.
He's a physical freak of proportions that can't be imagined.
He was only 6'9". No, he wasn't even close to 6'5". He just barely got to 6'6".
Right. I mean, you're, and yet he
was a power forward. At power 6'6". Forward,
leading the NBA in rebounding.
Yeah, yeah.
Matt, the reason I say that is this: you take Shaq or any center, it doesn't matter. Maybe not Embiid because he can shoot from the outside, but you take Shaq and you make him 6'4". Is he the same player? You take Charles Barkley and make him 7'2", and he might have averaged 50 a game. He might have been another Will.
Yeah, well, height is clearly an advantage in basketball.
That's right. And this guy at 6'4 and a half, 6'5", was leading the NBA in rebounding. I mean, the guy, I thought he said at the end of his career he was pumping, what do you call it when you keep pump faking? He said he was pump faking, because he couldn't jump anymore, right? He said till the cows were coming home. Having said that, and I'll jump just a little on the Phillies. It's way early in the season, obviously. Baseball is a typical. I know you guys you guys haven't even focused on that yet. But to the Phillies right now, I mean, like you said, Jeff, last night, they came around two nights. Or was it when Wheeler pitched last? I never seen the bottom drop out of a game. A guy who this is five innings, he struck out 10, and then gave up four runs in less than like 3.5 minutes.
Right.
So it can be a difficult situation, and then we got the Eagles draft coming up.
Right.
Any thoughts on that?
That's going to be a different team.
Yeah, I you know, they'll probably draft a lineman, defensive lineman or an offensive lineman, because that's what they always do.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that, actually.
Yeah. I think a cornerback wouldn't be the worst idea. You know, we could use a cornerback. Anybody who can tackle. I mean, listen, I think the three of us could probably get – I mean, at the end, in that playoff at the end of the year, in the last game, oh, my God. You ever seen anything like it?
That was embarrassing.
Yeah.
I mean, it is football, right? You're supposed to tackle.
To lose all those games in a row, it's still
– It's just so embarrassing.
It's still such a head-scratcher. I can't figure it out.
No, it's one of the worst.
And now the league has changed the rules with regard to tackling. You can't do the drop hip tackle. Are you familiar with that?
I probably am. I just don't know what it is.
If there's a guy running and you're catching up to him and you drop your hip and you pull him down that way, they're not allowing that again this year.
Or on kickoffs too.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit of a different game.
They can't take off until the guy catches the ball.
Right.
That's going to be crazy.
Yeah,
I mean, the guy catches the ball, he's got 30 yards.
Bingo. You're going to see a lot of touchdown.
I think
returns.
So.
Wait a minute. Where are they kicking from now?
They're kicking from the same spot.
Yeah,
but because they were concerned about returners getting blasted, you know, like kind of what punt returners do. If they don't put their arms up, they're getting clocked for a safe catch. It's kind of happening with the kick returners because the guys are racing down so fast that by the time the kick returner gets the ball, he's got 2 feet from a defender.
I saw that, but here's one thing I don't understand, and maybe you guys can explain it to me. 95% of the balls are kicked through the end zone.
Well, that's the other thing they're trying to prevent from happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's going on with that?
Well,
a joke.
I think what's happening is they're trying to create more kick returns.
Yeah, see that.
So I'm not sure if they're moving the spot back. I'm not sure. But I know that you can't leave your spot until the kick return. I think this is the rule. The kick return's got to catch the ball, and then you tear down the field.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine what they did in that.
But I think the defenders are starting at, like, the 40-yard line, but I don't know where the kicker's kicking it from.
Well, it's a good question, because they were showing some things, and they were talking about it the whole time, and I didn't catch that part of the conversation.
Yeah, I think they're moving the guys up farther up the field.
They are moving them up.
But the kicker is still kicking from the 35-yard line, maybe? I don't know what they
kicked. Whatever it is, they still were kicking them through the end zone.
Yeah,
yeah, it was the 35-yard line. But, you know, who knows? Who knows?
Well, to me, what they're probably doing, guys, is they're looking at the injury stats, and they're going, we're losing this many players on these kickoffs. We got to. That's the only thing I
thought you were going to say, and then we have the primary April 23rd.
John is a big political guy, so we do a lot of politicians on this.
That's good.
We've done the governor. We've done the mayor. Both of them were losing by 2 points until they came on the Saul Alfred Zurbano show.
Governor Shapiro while I was in a cab in New York City.
That's right.
Going from my office down to the Southern District Federal Courthouse.
We were in that tight of a time.
Yeah.
I was
literally had the earpiece in. I'm telling the cab where to go. And then I'm stuck in traffic. So that the
with
show
the governor
went very well.
Of Pennsylvania.
On the radio.
Yeah.
So anyway, having said that.
Yeah, we'll talk a little law maybe.
Yeah, let's do that. And by the way, you know, that show was only, you know, that guy is only a couple rungs less than our guest today, Jeff. Yeah. Jeff, if you would, a little bit about yourself and the firm.
So I handle all workers' compensation matters in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, predominantly in the Philadelphia area, but we're all over the state. Gross & Kenny is the name of the firm. We have a good firm that's been around for a long time.
And John Zurbanos, even though your specialty is medical malpractice, the firm is fairly diverse in its personal injury representation. If you would, a little bit about yourself and, of course, the firm.
Yeah, we do a fair amount of medical malpractice. We do a lot of crime victims work, sexual assault work, meaning sexual assault is kind of like
civil sexual assault.
Yeah, it's kind of like under the umbrella of crime victims. So, you know, we represent people who are injured as a result of a crime where there's a civil remedy, for lack of a better word, you know, lack of security, you know, whatever. I mean, we try to come up with legal ways to find compensation for people or victims of crime. And then, you know, we do the garden variety cases where people are injured as a result of auto accidents and fall downs and those sorts of cases. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's funny. we used to, I personally used to do workers' comp, and I'm sure Jeff can speak on this, but, you know, workers' compensation has become such a specialized area of the law that there was no way I could continue to try to keep ahead of the game with workers' comp and still maintain my practice. So what happened with me is I started keeping the cases where there was a third-party, viable third-party case, you know, in a products liability action or somebody that you could point a finger at, for lack of a better word, that wasn't in the relationship of the employer-employee. And then I would hold on to those cases and then try to see what I could do with the comp part of it. And then I was realizing I'm getting ahead of my skis here. I got to get these cases now to workers' comp folks who do that exclusively, because it's that specialized, and no way I could keep on top of it all.
Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, they actually changed the law in 1996, and they totally revamped the Workers' Comp Act, and it became, I mean, it's huge. It's very complicated, but we're on top of all of that. We do a lot of work with third-party attorneys so that we actually do the building of the case for damages purposes for the third-party claim, and then we hand off the ball and you run with it.
And that's important because a lot of times someone's gets hurt on the job, and, you know, whether you believe it or not, the insurance carrier who's providing benefits for the injured worker, they're motivated to get that worker back to work, whether he or she's capable of going back to work or not. And that can jeopardize the case. If you got a really good third-party case, you don't want somebody blocking and tackling their treatment.
Right.
And then if you have a comp lawyer involved, he can advocate for that injured employee to make sure that they're still getting the care that they need. I mean, it's remarkable. I've had cases where I'm scratching my head, like, why did the comp carrier not accept this case?
Yeah, I mean, things are crazy, and I've seen all kinds of issues. But we usually get everything under control, and we make sure that the damages are preserved well for mm-hmm. the third-party claim so that we don't have those issues where there's a gap or there's a problem with treatment, and we only use really highly qualified medical experts so that they dovetail well with the third-party claim.
What type of third-party component works more cohesively with a work comp case? I ask because I'll throw a couple out there. One, you mentioned product liability, okay? But so
I'll give you a classic example.
Yeah,
I represented a guy who was driving his car, but delivering something to some place. You know, his job asked him, "Can you take this to so and so?" And there was no company car. He got in his car, he drove, and somebody's pulling out. There's an intersectional hit. The easy case was against the driver that pulled out in front of my guy, but that guy was grossly underinsured, and the airbag came blasting out of the console and took out our client's eye.
Oh, my God.
So, and that's the second case I had where an airbag, the propellants in the airbag were so strong, you know, in the old Takata cases, you know, it was almost like shrapnel coming out and killing people. In this case, it was just the force of the bag coming out and hitting the eye and damaging the eye to the point where the person lost their eyesight.
Oh my God.
So obviously the guy had a hell of a lot of treatment, and again we had this case, and that would be an example of a third party case,
right? But
and then the comp carrier gets their money back from the airbag or the car manufacturer, whoever it is. But that's just one example. I mean, in a car case, it would be the insurance company who insures the driver. The money you collect from that driver will go back to the carrier because they have subrogation, it's called.
So, yeah, and I've been dealing a lot with these subrogable issues where we negotiate that subrogation lien down to either nothing or nothing plus money back to my client. So the third-party attorney...
That's the magic, because he can explain how he does that.
So the third-party attorney who's handling the third-party case doesn't ever think that the carrier shouldn't get their money back. And under the law, they're entitled 100% to get their money back, not dollar for dollar, but dependent upon the recovery amount and the attorney's fees and the costs of litigation on the third-party claim. Depending on what that yields, there's a formula to determine how much would become the net lien, meaning the lien after the calculation under this formula.
It's called pro rata share of recovery.
Yes, it is.
You can figure out what that means.
Exactly.
I'm looking right now on my legal dictionary.
So once they determine the net lien based on the pro rata share of recovery, the carrier always says, we want that. And you have to pay that back, and they do.
And you negotiate it.
Under Section 319, you're entitled to that back. They're entitled to that back. So what we do is we paint somewhat of a not great picture on the third-party claim. I mean, this case could go south on you. You could hit millions of dollars. But if it's not going to do well, the insurance company, the comp carrier, is not going to get their subrogation lien back. They may get zero.
And sometimes they don't care.
And sometimes they don't care.
I'm going to give you an example.
I'd like to know why.
I'm going to give you an example. I just had a case in Franklin County. That's out in Chambersburg.
Oh, there's a reason for that.
Chambersburg.
Yeah.
All right? And it was a all-terrain vehicle case. And the vehicle had been modified where they took the rope off the rope. It was like a roping. There weren't doors. It was like a safety rope. Yeah, it's like a safety rope, but like built like a door. If the door went open, you would be tossed into the rope.
Right? Almost like a netting.
Yeah. So they said, we took the rope off and they put doors on it, so we made it safer. But the doors, there was something wrong with the latches, and the doors just flew open, and that's what caused our client's injury. Her leg got trapped under the open door.
Oh my God.
And my argument was, therefore, the door not opening, she doesn't get hurt. And we got her doctor to say that. But she got hurt on the job. And the lawyer that had the case before us was able to settle the workers' comp case because she couldn't go back to that kind of work. Well, what happens then is that there's a workers' compensation lien, but it's so high that it's almost like, it almost makes it impossible to settle the case, because if I have a very difficult third-party case, and this was kind of a difficult case because, one, I'm arguing that you made the product more defective, which is, in Franklin County, kind of shot in the dark, and two, we have to argue the dynamics of injury, that the actual defect is what caused her injury. What you did to this thing is what caused this actual injury. And, you know, again, I don't want to disparage anybody who lives in central Pennsylvania, but they're a more conservative group. And, you know, they're not going to take too kindly to very creative theories of liability, although I don't think it was all that creative. I thought it was...
No, I mean, I think it's a viable...
Yeah, it was spot on, but it was a tough case.
It's a tough case.
And to make matters worse, and, you know, again, I don't want to get into trouble here, but our client was from New York City. I believe she was a gay woman from New York City, and she was having a hard time reconciling why she wouldn't be treated like a jury in New York would treat her.
Right.
And I said to her,
"Or Philadelphia,
maybe." I mean, the more urban your jury is going to be, the more open-minded, generally speaking, more open-minded you're going to get. It gets that again. I am just going off of my experience.
Right, right.
Again, I'm not trying to disparage anybody in conservative jurisdictions or conservative areas. But so I said to her, I said, you know the concept of a jury of your peers? She goes, yeah. I said, it's not gonna happen for you in this case.
Right.
So I'm trying to help her understand where her pitfalls are.
Right.
At the same time, I have this comp carrier saying, you know what? we spent a gazillion dollars on this case. We're not giving in. And then we went to a mediation, and the mediator had to get the carrier, the comp carrier, on the phone, and then they still wouldn't give in. And I was like, I'm not working for you. I'm working for her. Long story short, we got the case resolved.
And what happened with the subrogation lien?
Well, we wound up doing a third.
Okay, well, that's not uncommon.
Yeah, which is...
That's a common way of handling it.
Yeah,
yeah. The better way of handling it is to convince them that you're not going to win the case and that you got to take the settlement offer and your client won't agree because the subrogation lien is way too high and she might as well just not take it. So in those cases...
But then the carrier's like, well, what's in it for us?
Well, in those cases, the rule is something's better than nothing. Yeah. Remember, if it's not cost efficient, then you could say, you know what, I'm not even going to bring it because if you're not going to negotiate the subrogation lien, then I'm not going to bother wasting my money and time on this third-party trial.
Yeah, well, what happened, that was a case that had already, the comp case had already been resolved. You know, they settled it. So when we inherited the third-party case, this very large lien had already been put in place. So it was already set in stone.
So that's sometimes good and sometimes bad because the lien artificially increases the value of the claim. Because if you settle for a lump sum that's futuristic, meaning for future wage loss, future medical benefits, that is not yet, it hasn't happened. It's in the future. So it literally artificially inflates the value of the claim because it's assumed that that's going to be the damages of this person, mm-hmm. even though we haven't gotten there yet because it's in future time. And what that ends up doing is increasing the value on that third-party claim, but it also, at the same time, can make it more difficult to settle because it's too much value for what the claim is actually worth per the third-party assessed value.
No, I know, and it happens all the time.
Yeah.
And it frustrates judges because they can't settle cases.
Yeah.
And... it frustrates lawyers and it frustrates clients.
I'll tell you the easier way to do it. The easier way to do it is to not settle it that far in advance of the third-party claim being resolved. So the ideal...
That's great if you know who the comp lawyer is at the time.
Right, yeah. Right. That's true.
I was just going to say that.
This was like
that's
something...
That's why it's important.
We inherited this case.
Yeah.
It was one of those kind of deals.
That's why it's important for the comp attorney... And the third-party attorney to have
to
a good relationship
hand. Oh, yeah,
and
that,
to work
that's
hand
in very hand. Important.
That was my next question. My next question, when you have a case that can be somewhat complicated like this in regards to subrogation, is it important and is it typical that the third party and the work comp case attorneys work together?
Absolutely. And in fact, my example we were just talking about is that if the comp attorney and the third-party attorney are in sync and communicating properly, what ends up happening is the case doesn't settle until the third-party case is ready to settle, and then they can do a global mediation, and that is the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
And you know, that so there's a strategy that sometimes can go into this. And my question in relation to this, because, John, you mentioned this example, and I had not thought about this. I always give the when I think about a third party case, if I'm, you know, because I've got the opportunity to do shows with attorneys like yourselves, I always think when I'll say about the two easiest examples that I would have, and that would be, you know, if I was an iron worker working in a hole at one of the big jobs, and there was somebody, you know, when we call the hole, that's the, you know, the bottom, you know, the ground floor underneath of the before the building comes out of the hole. And so if you're walking and there's a big ditch and you dug that ditch and you fall in it, then it's work comp. You got injured yourself. But if somebody else dug the ditch and didn't put caution tape and you fall in it and it's another contractor, there's a third party there. Or if you're driving for a living and you're driving through a red light and somebody T-bones you, right? Those are examples that are cut and dry for some, person like myself who's just learning from listening. But you mentioned something, product liability. Let me throw a scenario. I'd love to know if this makes it any more complicated. I'm working on some kind of metal, a machine. Let's just say it's a, you know, it, you're cutting wood. It's a, you know, and I know a guy who was who was working one time, an iron worker with an auger, and it took his arm off. But so you're working on this machine, you're cutting sheet metal, right? And all of a sudden, you get injured at work, okay? You get injured, there's a big accident, maybe you lose a limb, unfortunately. And somebody looks at it and says, well, you got injured at work, there's nothing you can do. But then you find out that it's a faulty product. There was no guard on there, or you know, like at that point. Hey, Jeff Gross, how many uneducated, I'm not going to say, you know, attorneys, but somewhere in the process, would something, you know, how often does something like that get missed?
All the time. And it's not uneducated attorneys, it's unaware attorneys. Attorneys are all educated, otherwise they wouldn't be attorneys.
Right.
However, many people, including attorneys, if they don't have the experience of that type of issue coming across their plate before, they may miss that issue. And that's the problem if you don't know the issue. I'm going to throw something else out to you, and this is perfect for John. What happens when you have a work-related injury, not a third-party case, but a work-related injury, pure work-related injury? Let's just say you're lifting at work and you pull out your lower back and you have a major problem and you need surgery. And then the doctor does the surgery and botches it up because he deviated from the standard of care. So that operation did not happen when the work injury happened. It happened months, maybe even a year or so later, and he deviated from the standard of care in such a way that the damages that flow from that surgery, that botched surgery, were so significant that it warrants a malpractice claim. The real question is,
Is that a work injury related?
Is that a work-related injury? And if so, is there a subrogable component to it?
And what's the answer?
The answer is it depends on how material it is and what the damages were, if they were any different from what the original damages were.
Yeah.
There's something called the Poole decision, P-O-O-L-E, that governs that. But it's a really interesting case because it involves subsequent malpractice, medical malpractice, in a work-related environment where you have a work injury.
So the argument is, would that person still be out of work if not for the malpractice?
Exactly. And if the answer is the person would still have been out of work even if...
Then it's still workers' comp.
Then it's still subrogable.
But if they make a successful argument that it's the workers, it's the malpractice, which if you're the malpractice lawyer, you kind of want to come in and say, well, he or she was going to go back to work,
right?
If not for the malpractice,
exactly.
Right. How that's very interesting. By the way, is a way better example than the one.
It's just something
I had.
That happened in the past. But I'm saying, if you didn't know that, you wouldn't think about that issue.
Well, how would that issue that John Zervanos just brought up? Like, in other words,
the problem is in that scenario, the comp lawyer almost has to look at it because. In most cases, the comp lawyer is really not well-versed in malpractice issues. And, you know, I've learned a lot of medicine over the years because of what I do for a living. I mean, I've had some personal experiences that have educated me. But, you know, you learn a lot of medicine. You know, I got friends that throw their blood work at me and say, what does this mean?
Right.
And fortunately or unfortunately, I can interpret it for them.
Right.
You know, I told somebody, hey, you better call your doctor. I don't know if you've got end-stage kidney failure here. I mean, it was like, I mean, she had already had some kidney issues, but I was like, there's some serious stuff going on here.
You know, you just said that, and I got to ask you a question.
But the point is that comp lawyer has to be right on it and say, you know what, there might be something here. And then he has to contact a med-mal lawyer and say, hey, you want to take a look at this case? So it's like a two-part process. The comp lawyer has to spot the issue
right.
to begin with.
This is precisely the reason when comp lawyers and third-party lawyers are hanging out at a bar or talking or at a game or something, and people around them are like, God, you guys talk shop all the time.
Yeah. We're buzzkills, man.
Right. But the reason that we're talking shop is because these things come up.
And they torture us.
And they do torture
it's
us.
It's like you lose sleep over this
stuff.
You
do lose sleep.
I'll tell you this right now. This is about the most interesting conversation that I've been apprised to since I've been doing this radio show in regards
well,
to...
What's the public doesn't get it.
No.
Like, they just sit there and say, I don't understand why. It's just simple to me. You know, or I'll have somebody say, well, this is a slam dunk case. And I'm like, What's a slam dunk about it? Well, you know, this is what happened. I was fine until this happened, and I'll be like, unfortunately, you're not allowed to establish causation about your injury on a stand. You need a doctor to do it.
That makes me. That makes me. It's funny you say that because, you know, when I sit here, workers' compensation is routinely mentioned as such a specialty that, you know, like John, you said, you know, one, you know, obviously that, you know, you learned, you know,
it got ahead of me. I had right. to pass the. I had to pass it off.
Right. So that, and then Med Mal is you know, it's such a specialty. Both of these areas of law are such specialties that in your world, Jeff, there's actually a certification for it. And in your world, John, the case has to get certified.
Yeah, that's
so,
true.
So, but it, and so it's incredible. So I have never, you know, I've heard so many times that people have said, well, I had a buddy of mine. He's not a buddy of mine, my best friend, my brother, who just passed away not long ago. And this, by the way,
I hope not as a result of malpractice.
It was probably a result of his own, at the situation.
Non-compliance.
And I love him like there's, you know, I think about him every day. It's baseball season. Him and my wife are best friends since high school. Having said that. He was a terrible patient, the worst imaginable. But he calls me up one day, and he's from the hospital. This is 3 years ago. This, by the way, is probably the reason he's dead today, because he was so brutal. He wanted to get all he would do would ask the patient that the nurses when he's getting out, and it's no secret.
That's a problem with men.
Yeah, right. Well, that okay. Well, he was.
We also don't ask for directions.
So.
We're in denial all the time.
Yes. But here's the thing. He calls me and he goes, like, he's whispering. He's like, yo, I'm whispering right now. I'm like, why? What's up? He goes, I'm going to sue my doctor for malpractice.
While he's in the hospital. While he's in the hospital,
and I'm like, yes. You know.
And he's convinced that he has a case.
Well, and I'm like, yes, I don't know crap. I mean, that's, you know, I'm listening. By the way, this conversation with the two of you guys proves that I am a hack, right, as far as, you know, a show host. Because, you know, you're going back and forth at these high-level conversations. But I do know enough to know about causation and getting your case sort of
on. That's where the rubber meets the road on these cases. You know, breach of the standard of care when you think about it.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying it's easy, but you established that somebody didn't meet the standard of care. The problem is a lot of your clients, patients, have a lot of problems in some of these situations. That's why they have a complicated medical issue and it goes bad. And you can argue, hey, that doctor should have done X instead of Y. But then the argument is, had he done X, would he still have the client? Would he still have the same problem? And that's where a lot of clients can't wrap their head around.
Yeah,
they think if a mistake is made, mistake, breach of standard of care, they think they have a case. It's just automatic.
Or if the result was not the desired result.
You know, that's a different animal altogether. I got people call me all the time saying, I got bad medical care, and they really are just complaining about the way they were treated.
Yeah.
I had a guy, and I didn't know you then. When I got this, my brother-in-law called me. Guy lost his leg. His own doctor admitted it, and he still couldn't get a medical malpractice attorney to take the case. I got him one. They called me. This is years later, four years later, and he settled, right? He got $300,000. He wanted to call me up and say, listen, can I give you? I'm like, no, you can't give me any. In other words, $300,000, he'd probably be done that in two weeks.
If he lost his leg and got $300,000, it must have been a really tough case because he would think that case would be worth more than
$300,000. Well, my point is I was disappointed in it because I know the guy is.
It was probably a very difficult case.
Probably was, but that's the point. He lost his leg, and it was a very difficult case.
Yeah.
So what my buddies tell me, I'm like, I'm saying this to him. I'm like, Joe, I can't say that I'm a regular guy, but you probably don't have.
I have a case right now. It was absolutely horrible damages, and I'm not going to get into the specifics. And I recently met with the clients, and I'm at the first. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a hell of a case. And I'm hearing her story, and hearing her story, and hearing her story. And I'm like, well, then did you go back? Like, go back to the doctor. And you know they're frustrated, and they don't like the way they're being treated, and then they wind up not complying with what they're supposed to do. And then when you don't do that, you instantly create a defense for the medical professional.
Like a comparative negligence.
Well, you know that, you know, when you get out of the ER, you know what they always say? If you got a problem, go see your primary care doctor tomorrow. How many people can call their primary care doctor and get an appointment on the spot? I always crack up. It's like, I've actually cross-examined an ER person about, so the discharge instructions, see your primary care doctor tomorrow. Did you make that appointment for them? No, they're supposed to make it. How many people do you know can get an appointment the very next day at 9 o'clock in the morning as a follow-up? It just doesn't happen.
It's impossible.
It's impossible.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because my buddy discharged himself, and then he became an outpatient. Now it takes 6 weeks. Instead of you'll get these.
He discharged himself?
Yeah.
Well, that's a problem.
Right. But it turned out to be one.
And I'll tell you another workers' compensation nexus with medical malpractice issue that comes up, not all the time, but it does come up, is when you're relegated to treat with the panel physicians.
Yes.
The what physician?
The panel physicians of the employer.
Yeah.
You're
you
captivated.
Should explain what a panel physician is.
I will. So when you have a work-related injury, for the first 90 days, the rule is that you have to treat with a panel physician. Now, there's an asterisk there because there's all kinds of exceptions that we can find to get you out of treating with the panel physician, such as they make you have to sign an acknowledgement that you will treat when you're hired, and then again when you're injured with that panel physician.
With the list of
there has to be six, yeah. And there's a whole slew of requirements that are needed in order for them to perfect their right to captivate your treatment with these panel physicians. However, assuming that they do, and assuming that you're getting another type of benefit in addition to workers' comp, for instance, if you're making a lot of money and you're part of a union, they have these collective bargaining agreements that give you additional benefits for in exchange for you having to treat for the life of the claim with these panel physicians.
But okay. Technically, it's only for 90 days. Of the panel
technically,
physician.
It's only for 90 days. But if you're a municipality employee, like a City of Philadelphia employee,
yeah,
and you get a Regulation 32, or you
right.
get a heart and lung benefit, like a police officer or a firefighter, you have to treat with the panel list the entirety of the claim, or you'll get knocked off of that particular
and
program.
Can you imagine, in order to make the be a panel physician, think about it for a second, the panel physician has to play ball with the
okay,
city
time
or
the out.
Employer.
Hold up. This is I'm the kid in the back of the classroom now, right?
Okay,
we got a medical malpractice attorney and a work comp attorney on this same broadcast. John, we've had this conversation, Jeff and I, across the board. Why is it not medical malpractice? What a lot of these panel doctors, you talk about standard of care. I mean, mother of God, they're barely given, in some cases, they're barely given treatment.
In many cases, they're not even seen by a doctor. They're seen by physician assistants.
So why isn't John Zerfano turning this whole thing upside down?
Well, no one's calling me and saying somebody really messed up here. Can you look into this? But, you know, obviously that's a potential, that's an possibility.
Absolutely.
But these panel physicians, here's my experience, as limited as it is. If you got a catastrophic injury and you're a panel physician, you're not going to be stupid. You generally send them off to Rothman Institute for major operation or some specialist. You're like, this is above me. It's the folks that have, you know, the whiplash injuries, the strains and sprains, where that panel physician knows that this isn't going
There's
anywhere.
There's some gray area.
I'm going to control this and get this person back to work in 90 days. And that's really where I think that system was placed, so that you can control the folks that aren't so catastrophically.
So here's what's very interesting.
But I may be wrong.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
But here's what's very interesting, and this is an extrapolation of what you just said. The panel physician doesn't do surgery. They're simply, you know, primary care docs, or not even. They're you know, nurse practitioners, or they're physician's assistants. But at some point, it does get above their pay grade. And they say, well, I'm going to send you to Rothman or one of those facilities. Mm-hmm. And they send them where they want them. If my client decides, well, I don't want to get surgery from this guy that I don't know, and he's the guy that the panel doctor is referring to me, the municipality, like the City of Philadelphia, will invariably say, oh, no, you have to treat with who the panel doctor is recommending. And then
they call it in-network, right?
In-network. And then when they treat with those doctors and they create a malpractice issue in a surgical problem or other problem, you then have a really interesting situation.
Are they protected by the workers' comp law?
They're not protected.
Yeah, they're not.
Well, I had a situation where a guy I went to high school with, his brother, he was in one city union. They were in, and his brother was a labor leader in the other union. And he went. You have to go in network, and you got to go where they tell you to go. Well, he went. He stayed. This guy stayed in network, but he went to another doctor in network. You can, in that scenario, you can lose your job. My opinion is the labor leader who negotiated that did not understand workers' compensation or work injuries. He just thought all doctors were the same and all situations. Well, didn't realize.
I've had personal experience with my clients who decide that they really don't want to go to that particular referral from the panel doctor to that surgeon to get the surgery, and they go elsewhere, and they've been
not terminated, but
they've been blackballed by the union. And the union refuses to get involved and help them when there's a problem.
Wow.
And they say, look, we told you to go there, and you didn't go there, and we're all bets are off now.
Listen, this was negotiated by years and years and years ago, okay, by labor leaders that are no longer there. Okay, and they might have been good, and it might not have been intentional, but they were snowballed, in my
opinion. Now, why would the union care so much?
It's in their collective bargaining agreement. So when there's one inch of a deviation from that agreement, and there's a basis to terminate the employee from the employer, the union does not step up and file a grievance or any kind of appeal or anything, because the union has the position that the claimant, their worker, deviated from the collective bargaining agreement.
Wow. In one of the city unions, they had an advocate for years, and we're honoring her in our Legends of Labor Hall of Fame, okay? And her name is Kathy Black. Unbelievable. She was able to make, leeway with these people. She saved more people, and she's a first woman getting inducted into our Legends of Labor Hall of Fame. And it's around Mount Rushmore, but the other union that my buddy was in, she was in the union that actually has a support system. Okay, DC 47.
Mm-hmm.
33 at the time did not have one. And my buddy, his brother was a labor leader in 47. They had the support system. DC 33 at the time didn't. Now they got some good labor leaders in there now. But it's my opinion, John, it's not that they didn't care about it. They cared about getting, when they were at the negotiating table, they took the raise and
try to get the deal.
And try to get the deal, not realizing what was going on. I don't think it was done intentionally.
No, I know.
But you did have some schemers.
There's always ramifications, and there's like, oh, we didn't think of that.
Exactly.
And now we're stuck.
It's like the lawyer that's not aware of the issue that's before him or her.
Yeah.
Right. So, look, we have 3 minutes left. Even though I know John wants to go another two hours.
This went fast. This was fun.
It does. Yeah. We'll
have to have Jeff back because we got a lot of issues to cover.
It's interesting stuff.
It really is. I'm learning. I'm learning as we're talking. Jeff Gross. First of all, I want to get. I like to get this. This is my favorite thing about what you guys do. Contingencies for the agreement. People walk into your offices in terrible shape, whatever the situation is, but they don't come out of pocket to retain your services or get counsel, correct?
Correct. They never pay out of pocket for anything unless I recover money for them and they're still not paying out of pocket. We're taking it from the settlement.
Same
and
with
it's
you?
Limited to 20%.
John Cervantes?
Yeah, we are the same thing. I mean, our fees are not capped at 20%. The workers' comp, that's the state legislated.
Sure.
So our fees are generally determined, the percentage is generally determined on the type of case that we're doing.
Sure.
So if it's a more of a
complex or a lot more.
If it's a simpler case, it's going to be a third. If you get into the real complex stuff, the fees go up. I mean, the percentages go up. But that's because the risk is enormous. And I explained that to clients. I said, we're taking on huge risk here. The case could cost $200,000-$300,000. And if you take that one particular case, and then you realize you have 20 or 30 of them that are just like it at $200,000-$300,000, that lawyers lose sleep at night because you got $3 million out on the street.
But the client never comes out of their
never
pocket.
Comes out of their pocket. We lose, we eat it.
Okay, gentlemen. Contact information: Jeff Gross at Gross and Kenny.
Yes, Jeffrey Gross. My phone number is 215-512-1500, and it's a very easy number to remember. You can get me there Anytime.
What's the website?
It's my website is www.fellowworkerscomp.com, or my email address is jgross@gk-wcl.com.
Awesome. John Gervano's contact information here at the firm.
You know, I should have full command of all the telephone numbers that we have. And I know we have an 800 number, but I don't know what it is.
But what's the website?
I know our website is soloffandgervanos.com. And that's the easiest way to get a hold of us, because all the telephone numbers are on that website.
That's what I'm talking about. And you can, Google.
I did want to add something to what I just said. I want our listeners to understand, when I talk about all the money we're putting out, you know, there's such huge risk. We're not taking the case unless we really feel confident that we're going to win it.
Sure.
You don't want to take flyers on these cases.
Yeah, right.
So if I tell you I think we're going to accept your case and we're going to fund it, it's because we feel like we can win the case.
Sure. All right. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Soloff and Gervano Show. We want to thank our guest, Jeff Gross of Gross & Kenny, fantastic workers' compensation firm, and a great radio host at that. And, of course, we want to thank John Zervanos, our host from Soloff and Gervano's, for everybody here at Soloff and Gervano's. I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.